Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We're doing an indoor recording today because it's a bit grey and miserable outside, so it felt like being indoors. So the question that has been on my mind recently is is there any hope for the human species? And the reason why I've been thinking about this, and me and Pete have been talking about it quite a lot, is because we've been watching a lot of history programs, and particularly we've been watching the whole of Andrew Marr's History of the World, which is on YouTube now. And it really is incredible to just look back and see how these massive civilizations have come into being and conquered this country and the next country and another one, and build a like a massive fleet of ships to go and sail across the sea and conquer some more land, and then they rise to this pinnacle of what seems like an unstoppable progress, and then things crash and they're sort of swept away by the next one. And then the next massive unstoppable civilization rises out of the ashes and then dies away. And then there's the next one. And there just seems to roll on and on with this amazing human drama. And I feel that just looking at the history that we've looked at, and also we've been watching an excellent series on the BBC called The Ascent of Woman, which you absolutely must watch if you can, because it's brilliant. It's like world history from the point of view of women. And it's surprising how many women have actually come to great prominence and power and changed the world. And then their successes...
Written out of history.
Then basically written out of history, yeah. And there's Margaret Sanger, a very brave woman who popularised the term birth control and opened the first birth control clinic in the United States. Well, just how much she changed the world, and particularly for women,
you know. Yeah.
So my thoughts were just that it seems to me that slowly, very, very slowly, the world is becoming... or rather, humans are becoming more compassionate. And I know in a lot of places it's still really awful, I know, but I said very, very slowly, the world is becoming a more equal place and we are becoming more sensible. And this is my hope. And certainly watching the series about women, and, you know, obviously how women had to fight to get the vote, and, you know, they fought an awful lot for equality. But bit by bit, not in every society, obviously, but the one I'm living in right now, anyway, it has bit by bit got a lot better, to the point where me as a woman living in this society now, I don't feel that there's any difference. You know, I feel completely free to do what I want to do and not to be oppressed by sexism or anything like that. So we've just been discussing this just to take in the scope of the last, say, certainly the last 3,000 years, and how things have been changing, and how we've been socially evolving. This idea of social evolution is very, very interesting to me at the moment. So, let's start off then. So, Pete, is there any hope for the human species? What do you think?
Well, my first instinct is to reply no. I'm not as optimistic as you about where we've come. I mean, like the case of women. Okay, I think through a lot of struggle, women have made advances in Western Europe and America in terms of civil rights and so forth. And But there's still a long way to go. I think there's still a long way to go. I think patriarchy is still kind of quite entrenched.
Oh, yes. And, absolutely. And I'm not saying it's perfect. It's just improved a bit.
I mean, somebody like Steven Pinker, I think it's him, he thinks that human beings have got less violent over time.
Yeah.
And he's done quite a lot of fairly detailed research, I think, there, and he's able to make a reasonably convincing case.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to be the case to me.
Case for
that would be that it seems that. True. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, talking about watching documentaries, I watched the Panorama about the Chinese leader. Now, obviously, Mr. Ping, whatever he's called, Xi, has. He's been fated in London because they want the breadheads in London obviously want some slice of the Chinese pie, so they fated Mr. Xi. But at the same time, Panorama has to show the BBC's radical credentials.
Yeah.
By doing a bit of a hatchet job on him, you know, and saying, well, he's a dictator, and of course he is. You know, certainly the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party. It's a vicious oligarchy that rules over 1.2 or 1.3 billion people.
Mm.
I mean, I take a look around every day, and it seems to me that human beings are busy, spend a lot of time, a lot of energy just hurting each other, exploiting each other, killing each other, and for stupid reasons.
Yeah.
And there's now a lot more of us than there's ever been.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, 7-8 million, hurtling towards 10 billion or whatever.
There's a lot more stupidity to go around.
There's a lot more stupidity to go around. So, I kind of feel if I'm going to be just dead clear and dead realistic, there is no hope. There's no hope in the sense that it seems to me sort of fairly unlikely we aren't actually bloody destroy ourselves.
Yeah.
And we've certainly had the wherewithal since 1945. Well, 1944 or whenever it was that they tested the bomb at Los Alamos.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a bit of hope. We haven't blown ourselves up yet.
We haven't, no, not quite. Come close a couple of times. I mean, I lived through the Cuba crisis, you know, and remember it very, very vividly. The mass fear of that when Russia and, well, the then Soviet Union and the United States started pointing intercontinental ballistic missiles at each other, or short-range missiles at each other with massive hydrogen bombs on the tip, you know, come very close to vaporising each other's cities.
Yeah.
So, you know, was it pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will?
Yeah.
But when we've been talking
about this, we've come up with reasons why there's no hope, but also reasons why there's hope as well. But what we were deciding we wanted to start off with was, you know, what is hope? And so if we were going to say, yes, there is hope for the human race, what would a yes answer entail?
Yeah, good question. I mean, as you mentioned, we were thinking about this for days, really, haven't we? We kept coming.
Well, we've been at it for weeks.
You got inspired by a sense of the sweep of history and the rise and fall of empires and the absolute... We sit here and we watch this stuff and we go, fucking hell, the maniacs.
I know.
The humans, man, they are absolutely just completely extra.
They're constantly amazing.
They're over the top, though, and they're pretty vicious when they get going.
Yeah.
And violent. And I think, the problem, I'd say, is violence. And if we need to think about hope, I mean, you're kind of thinking about violence as well.
Mm.
But okay, rambling a bit here. The way in is to say, well, what is hope? What is hope? Well, obviously, you know, we've got to know what we're talking about. And the Oxford Dictionary says something like, hope is the expectation of something desired. And I would like to just expand on that, you know, and say that hope is, it's a kind of future thinking. And it's the reasonable expectation of gaining some good in the future. So the concept of hope connects the future to desire. But through imagination, because we only ever imagine futures, And through evaluation, because we have to decide what it is that we want, and that's a matter of evaluation.
Yeah.
You know, we evaluate from amongst the cluster of desires, which is this one better than that one? The other thing about this is that it's possible to talk cogently about false hope and real hope.
Mm.
And what that introduces is the notion of possibility. A false hope is the hope that you hold out, that a certain future will unfold or transpire or arrive. That's actually impossible. That's the bare false hope. Yeah. Or even just very, very unlikely. It might be possible, but it's very unlikely. That is false hope.
Yeah.
Real hope, or hope per se, is allied to the notion of the possible. And that's why I use the term here, reasonable expectation of gaining some good in the future.
Mm.
So this little analysis of hope throws a few things into relief. It actually tells us about the nature of our question and the vastness of our question, as usual. You've asked a vast question. And so I would say that hoping for a good human future, well, first of all, it entails that the human race is set up to survive for a few billion years more.
Yeah, until we fall into the sun, maybe.
Into the sun, rather than like in the next 100 years, because some drunken idiot in the Pentagon...
Fell
on the switch, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the given, right? But other than that, the hope for a good human future brings us face to face with... This is a mini summary, isn't it? It brings us face to face with, well, the good. Firstly, the good. The desired future.
Mm.
What is the good future? What is it? What do we want? What do we want collectively? What would anybody sensible want for the human future?
Yeah.
If anything, is it even sensible to think about the future? Some people don't know. They go around making a very nice living, publishing books and giving lectures, saying, don't think about the future. You know,
yeah.
So but I'm going to just take it that human beings think about the future because they have children, they have descendants.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just going to take that and all this kind of like giving yourself a lobotomy is just another piece of stupidity. That's an ostrich posture.
Mm.
In yoga, we call it ostrich asana. Yeah. Put your head in the sand.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, on the one hand, it's nice to have half an hour meditation where you completely take a break from thinking about anything, future, past, whatever, which is very nice. But you do have to think about the future.
Yeah.
And human beings always have. Otherwise, our species wouldn't have survived this long if we didn't have a really good capacity for anticipating the future and working with anticipated problems. We'd all be dust.
You're right. You're dead right. I mean, certainly it's good hygiene. It's good mental hygiene to forget occasionally, you know. Certainly I sometimes, when I'm teaching meditation in the yoga class, I say this is a Taoist meditation, which traditionally is known as forgetting. You just literally forget everything for half an hour or an hour or 2 hours or half a day, whatever you feel.
Which is really nice.
It's hygiene. It's like brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
You get a build-up of plaque if you don't do that.
That's right,
And your mental teeth drop out.
Yes.
You know. But anyway, that's just another thing. So I've said, you know, that we've got these massive conceptual fields that come into view when we start thinking about hope.
Mm.
It's particularly about hope for a good human future. One, as I said, is the good. What is the good? What is the good human future? What do we desire? The desired future. I mean, obviously, that's kind of bringing us into the situation where we need to think about desire as well.
Mm.
So it gets tricky. The second one I want to mention is the future. Well, the future. What is the future? We need to think about time in general, and time from the human perspective, from how it's lived, how we understand it, how we have a sense of it through something that's uniquely human, the study of history and collective memory and so forth. So we need to think about time and we need to think about the future. The third one is the possible. As I said, you know, real hope is possible. Real hope is a desire to actualise something that's possible.
Yeah.
But there is such a thing as false hope. So we need to think about possibility. What is possible for the human future? You know, can we even know that, or can we have a sense of it? Can we make estimates of the probability of such and such a thing being able to occur at all? And there's another one. There's a fourth field that jumps into view, and that is the acts of imagination and evaluation. Yeah, two acts: the act of evaluation and the act of imagination. Now, if you're thinking about the future, what we do, of course, is we imagine it.
Mm.
We have to imagine it, you know. We picture it. We try and construct it in imagination. Well, what is that? Can that be refined? Is it reliable? How reliable is it? How does it work? Can it be cultivated?
Mm.
Is it something we should throw into the bin altogether? Similarly, evaluation. And evaluation is, I think, a big philosophical problem that's really, really should be engaging minds in a big style. You know, it's the problem for our generation of philosophers and thinkers and novelists and artists. How do you evaluate? How do you tell? How do you tell that this possible future is preferable to that possible future?
Yeah, well, everyone would have completely varying ideas, wouldn't they?
Well, of course, as we know, there is just like ongoing argument.
Yeah.
About what the desired future ought to be for everybody. There's been arguments since the beginning of time about in which direction we should steer everything.
Yeah, which utopia we should go for.
Yeah, but of course what usually happens is that a strong man with a gang just grabs hold of the rudder and just steers the thing anyway.
Yeah.
So, and I'd say all of these four things, they're all vast and deeply problematic philosophical problems, and actually practical problems for human beings. So hope, thinking about hope has just opened up a load of doors, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So I can kind of go through those and see if it gives us a bit of a map of the territory.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the most we can hope to achieve it in a short time, is to get a little bit of a sketch map.
Mm.
For tackling it, but
I mean, we could say, well, maybe I would like to say here what I would hope for the human species, and I think I would like to think that anyone who's reasonably rational and intelligent would also want these things, where the population was healthy. And there was the least amount of suffering possible, because there's always going to be suffering. There's nothing we can do about that. You know, people will be ill. They will have accidents and they will have loss in their life. It will always happen. But obviously there's a greater and lesser amount that that could be happening. So for me, what I would be hoping is that there is the least amount of suffering possible. And that, so that would mean that nobody was starving. We all had adequate nutrition, and we weren't all sort of working so hard at stuff that we hated doing, that we had time to be creative and to enjoy our lives as much as possible as well. Would be nice. I quite hope that for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
and for you know, just to reduce the suffering, so we've got enough food. Our problems with providing electricity and power are sorted out in a way which don't harm the planet. And hopefully, with our extra time that we have in our hands, because we're not working quite so hard, we have time to come up with some really good ideas to perhaps start repairing some of the damage that we've done to the planet, so that we don't kill ourselves with pollution. So, but it's basically down to suffering. That's what I would wish.
Yeah,
that was my hope, that there will be the minimum amount of suffering for all humans. And this would, include equality, and no group hating another group just because they're, you know, a different sex, a different colour, a different something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think there's not much that I would want to argue with about that. You know, as you know, I'm a bit of a hippie. So for me, you know, my values are the old totally altruistic, wishy washy hippie values of love and peace.
Yes.
You know, and what is not to like? I keep saying this. What is not to like about love and peace? And it just amazes me that you actually say, well, let's just take these as central values and see what we need to do to kind of instantiate them in real human society.
Yeah.
And people kind of get really, really angry. Say, what? No war? What? No military? What? No saluting the fucking flag? What? No kissing the Queen's ring? You know. And as though you were insane and that war was somehow desirable because it gave this kind of shitty thing they call glory or something like that, you know. And, yeah. Okay, it does give human beings the opportunity to be brave and so on.
But for me,
I want to live in a peaceful society, and I want the descendants of this generation to live in a peaceful society, and that means an equitable society.
Mm.
There has to be a reasonable degree of equality. There should be no vast inequalities of access to goods. And privileges and power, you know, and, you know, the ability to make things happen, at least in your own life.
Mm.
But also the maximum degree of individual freedom that's possible.
Yeah.
As well. And as you say, like, leisure is a good.
Yeah.
But technically, we live in a generation that's within spitting distance of solving the problem.
Yeah.
Of what's called necessity.
And that's what's so frustrating, is that we really do have everything we need to bring about this peaceful society.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so that would be my idea of the good. You know, I've said here, you know, what is the good? What future do you desire? Well, we've just given all the clues that are needed here, because we both kind of stated a desire. Which is basically, you know, we want to live in a society in which the hippie values, love and peace, are instantiated and actually really, really exist and organise things, and we don't waste all our time killing and torturing each other.
Yeah.
And that we have leisure with which to produce art and culture and with which to love each other and to explore the
wonders of the planet.
The wonders of the planet and the wonders of our own inner life, you know, and all of this is well within the realms of possibility, I think. You know, we talked about possibility.
Yeah.
Well, why is that impossible?
Infinitely possible.
It's infinitely possible. What's stopping us?
Yeah.
You know, what's stopping us?
Yeah.
But, you know, we've got to be a bit careful. We get carried away with our utopian.
Oh, no.
Our utopianism here. And how can we actually evaluate that future? And this is the tricky problem, and I think it's such an important philosophical problem that we just need to be getting the best brains on the planet kind of thinking about, debating about, producing texts about, producing television programmes about, getting information out about, and just having thrashing it out. How do we actually, how have you and I arrived at this? We've actually evaluated. I just did it, didn't I? I evaluated, I weighed a peaceful society against a society that's central value is waging war.
Yeah.
I just did it in a few kind of throwaway sentences. I weighed them on a scale.
Yeah.
Can you see how I did? But what happens when you do that? Will you imagine the future? You know, and especially when we're talking about the human future, what we're doing is we are on a quite egotistical level, we're asking, what kind of an ancestor do I want to be?
Yeah.
Because we're going to be somebody's ancestors, and I would, just as a matter of ego pride, like to think that in two generations' time, the descendants of this generation will look back and say, our ancestors were great. They really bequeathed us something.
Mm.
And that, I mean, it's kind of infantile ego wish for some kind of immortality and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, I do actually kind of feel that. So there's a sense in which there's a sort of a self-examination going on there. And okay, I kind of try to dismiss it as egotism, but of course it can be a little bit more can be, I don't know, what's the word, you know, a bit more serious than that and a bit more profound than that, in as much as there's a self-inquiry immediately.
Yeah.
This whole kind of question of hope, this whole question of evaluation brings about a self-inquiry. It's a self-inquiry, what kind of ancestor do I want to be?
Mm.
What do I actually want for these children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? And you try then to imagine their lives.
Yeah.
And you know, this is where imagination comes in.
Yeah.
So.
But in some way, we don't exactly need to imagine it because we have like pretty good historical records.
Yeah.
Not great, but pretty good, and we can read the history books and watch documentaries about what's happened, and it's quite clear that certain actions or conquering nations rushing off with their swords in the name of whatever god that they're going to go and slaughter some people in this time. We can kind of see the consequences of what happens. So we have a huge amount of information to draw upon to enable us to make decisions.
Yeah. Well,
and evaluate.
I think there's a problem there. I think we. We have a mass of what appears to be like information, but
it'll be a bit subjective.
It's not all the information that we've got is of equal value. Some of it's just sheer fantasy, and of course, nobody has ever had such access. No generation has had such access to this quasi information that we have.
No,
I mean, what is it? I don't know. It's like if you were to watch all the YouTube videos that were uploaded in an hour, it's 10 years or something. I don't know. It's some kind of, I don't know whether that's the right figure, but it is absolutely mind-boggling just how much stuff there is. But some of it's crap.
Yeah, but that's exactly why, because that's exactly why we're in a great position to make decisions and evaluate now, because we don't just have one history book anymore. We can have 10 history books all about the same thing with a little bit of a different spin, a different take giving. So what we can have now is we can have lots of different perspectives on the same thing.
Well,
and that's so important.
Yeah. Historical writing is always interpretation. There's no escape from that.
Yeah.
But not all interpretations are as good as each other.
No.
Either. You know, and this is again evaluation. You need to be able to evaluate an interpretation.
Yeah.
And that is a fairly complex thing that perhaps we could at some point do a podcast and really get into the detail of the way we think that this works. But I mean, just to sketch it out, I mean, we do use imagination, but we do also appeal to whatever facts we've got at our disposal, i.e. manuscripts, reports, archaeological remains, carbon dating of skeletons, etc.
Right.
You know, so there's that whole business there of imagination, and also imagination enables us to ask the questions.
Mm.
It's like an archaeologist who's scraping away at some ancient, say an ancient grave, and he sees like a certain configuration of artifacts in the grave.
Yeah,
imagines how they got there.
Yeah,
and then that imagining is a hypothesis, and then tests the hypothesis.
Yeah,
I mean, some archaeologists they actually go out and try and mimic the making of a flint tool with a piece of flint, so they can see what the pattern of the debris is.
So
you then test your hypothesis empirically.
Yeah, and also the way that the person died. I mean, that's actually just a little aside. Yeah. That's been very interesting. So in the historical stuff,
were they sacrificed? Yeah, did they die in battle? Were they massacred? Did they die of old age? What diseases did they have?
Yeah.
Etc.
Yeah.
You know. So.
And like particularly like whether they died of like a violent death in battle, whether they, you know, where the head was caved in, or whether they died of old age. Like there were some societies, weren't they, when they digged up a lot of the graves, it seemed that like there was virtually no violent death. All the
Çatalhöyük in Anatolia, which is at least 9,000 years old.
Yeah,
there are no weapons in the remains.
Yeah, which is amazing.
And people are buried under the foundations of the houses.
Yeah.
And if you examine the DNA, they're not related to each other, so they seem to live in communes.
So it's a great communal society. Groups.
Yeah.
That can't have been a warlike society because of the lack of weapons.
All of the houses are the same size. There's no big house where the Lord lived or a temple where the god is supposed to have lived. They were just all the same.
Yeah.
So it's obviously...
I thought that was a matriarchal society.
Yeah, possibly. There's some people have suggested that. But, yeah. we can't kind of conclusively prove it. But what the lesson of all this is, I mean, well, there's two lessons, well, probably more than two, but the two I want to draw at this point is to say history is a matter of interpretation.
Yeah.
And you know, that is why it's possible to talk about a conservative historian like Niall Ferguson, or something, you know, or a radical historian, or a Marxist historian like. Yeah.
But there are actual facts within it that are indisputable. Yeah.
But we also have to work with and honour whatever factual material we've got.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the account is underdetermined by the facts. Well, fortunately, I think it's actually quite fortunate. So that's a point we need to take on board. But you are able to evaluate the methodology as of historians, and you know it doesn't place this underdetermination of historical accounts by whatever facts we've got at our disposal doesn't mean that we can't kind of bring critical evaluations to bear onto historical accounts. You can, but it's very difficult and gets very, very involved, especially as we now have so much material and of varying quality. But we can kind of almost like ride roughshod over all of those problems by just saying, well, the study of ancient history certainly shows just how many vastly different modes of social organisation have been possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the society with no king to societies in which the king has the power of life and death over a slave population.
Yeah.
And everything in between.
Yeah.
The democracy of the ancient Greeks.
Yeah.
The legalism of the Confucians in China.
Yeah. All that stuff.
The caste systems in India. The thing that the Incas had got, where they just did deals with neighbouring tribes. So we'll kind of protect you and give you the benefits of our organisation ability in exchange for some tax.
Yeah, or, you know...
Well, which wasn't even money, because they didn't even have money.
They didn't even have money, you know. The Incas didn't have money and they didn't have writing, and their architectural feats and their agriculture was astounding.
Yeah, so... And a vast empire.
Yeah.
You know. So, but the point there is that almost anything is possible.
Yeah.
And so if almost anything is possible, that notion of the possible restraining the future is one that you can push the limits of that. And especially now, as I say again, I think the technology's there, at least in principle, if there's the will to basically overcome what philosophically we call necessity, which is, you know, the problem of making sure everybody's got enough food, enough clean water, somewhere to live, the wherewithal to prevent and overcome and cure diseases, and so on.
Yeah.
And educational systems and all of these possibilities of just looking after the necessities of life.
Yeah.
We've never been better placed.
No.
To sort that out, but never in some sense is worse placed, because people still with just very, very, very sadly still bombing each other and all the rest of it, and for idiotic reasons. So, What's going on with this? Now, obviously, there are kind of material conflicts between tribes. I mean, it's a commonplace that the interventions of the West in the Middle East are about oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people argue that all conflict and all violence, and after all, it's conflict and violence that's standing in the way of the realisation of the hippie goods of love and peace.
Yeah.
Conflict and violence as institutional ways of life.
Yeah.
What supports conflict and violence as institutional ways of life? Well, stories, big stories, you know, grand narratives. The grand narratives don't cause the violence. Maybe it is the greed for oil that causes the violence, but they justify it.
Mm.
They say, you know, America has a manifest destiny. You know, or coming back from the other direction, you know, we've been commanded by the infallible book to spread the word by the sword.
Yeah.
Etc. You know, and that...
Righteous wars.
And what is always justifying human idiocy is a grand narrative that somebody is prepared to die for and to cut somebody else's throat for.
Yeah.
But if you watch enough history documentaries, you'll realise that not only are the types of civilizations that have actually existed being absolutely varied and manifold, but also like the belief systems that underpin those civilizations and justify the actions of those civilizations are equally varied.
Yeah.
And we should draw a lesson from that. We should draw a lesson from that, that the big stories possibly don't have the absolute certainty that is generally attributed to them.
Mm.
It's almost like a part of adhering to a big story, of subscribing or being locked into a big story, is that you believe it's the last word. You have to believe it's the last word.
Yeah.
Which is why I think all this shit about multicultural societies being tolerant and the great religions being tolerant is wrong. They're not tolerant. A grand narrative, a big story, can only function if the adherents of the big story believe it's the last word and are prepared to kill and die for it. That is built into Christianity, into Islam, even into Buddhism, even into the peaceful religions that are just right up front there with the hippie values. Push comes to shove. This is the last word, and don't you fucking step over the line. Don't you insult that.
Mm.
Don't you act in a way that's not informed by that. So, for me, there is no hope for the human race unless they're prepared to absolutely drop that locked-inness to the big story. That we just now refuse to be locked into big stories.
Yeah, and another way to describe that is it's just a common term that we use. It's just like being called narrow-minded, isn't it?
Yeah.
And because I think that the way I would describe that is there is hope for the human race if people become capable of seeing a situation or another person from more than one perspective at the same time.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah,
it would be the more perspectives that you can yeah inhabit at
yeah
the same time when examining something
yeah
or a situation
yeah
or a person, yeah, the better. And the less likely it is that you will just get sucked into some sort of belief which says, well, we better go and just kill them all because they don't believe this or their, you
yeah
know,
well,
stone them to death because
it gives you
they did
it
this
gives,
or
it
this
gives you an excuse for conquest, for violence, conquest through violence.
Yeah.
But I think if people are going to do conquest through violence, they should just say to themselves, I just feel like being violent. And
yeah
look themselves in the eye and say, well, I'm just through violence going to conquer these
yeah
these buggers. And just be honest about it instead of saying, oh, God wants me to do it.
Yeah. Because when you
I think it would be much less likely to happen then, and
yeah
I do think it's desirable that in the future that this stuff fades out.
Yeah.
I do not want
which is
our
a,
ancestors to
no
our what's not ancestors descendants to live in a global Damascus, you know.
Yeah. So. And that's another reason why I feel there's hope for the human species is because, although I've, you know, depends which part of the world you're listening to this in, but. Where I am here in Wolverhampton, I'm completely free to be an atheist, which I am, and or believe it actually have any beliefs that I want to, or have lots of beliefs, or none.
I believe in the aliens from the planet Zarg, and because of that, I hope against hope.
But nobody's going to lock you up for it, you know, or stone you.
Well,
to
I
death
don't know. They might. It depends who you tell. Don't tell your psychiatrist.
Yes, don't mention that.
The aliens from the planet Zarg peering in through the window.
So we are free. There are many societies across the world where there is more freedom, and it seems to be, from what I can understand of the world, that it's becoming more and more free. And ideas that are locking people into harmful modes of behaviour are being challenged
yeah
much more than they ever
I think it's
have
getting,
been.
I mean, there is a part, there is a kind of a logic to this, you know, is that, okay, we have an increasingly technical society, and that's kind of inevitable given that the population's massive and rising. and that the problem of necessity is just that, a necessary problem. Providing the basic goods of life for the population is something that has to happen. That's not going to be solved with this amount of population without technical means, and technical means can only be developed by an educated workforce, by an educated population.
Yeah.
So, but education, of course, even the most narrow education, real education, if it's going to open up to the dynamism of inquiry, if it's going to make possible technical developments that are going to deal with the various aspects of necessity, that is necessarily a liberal education in the sense that questioning is placed into the forefront of that education, rather than just filling kids with a story and beating them if they don't live up to it.
Yeah,
we're saying, well, we need people who can inquire, because if we do not have people who inquire, there really is no hope.
Well,
because
yeah.
we won't even yeah. just on that technical level of sorting out necessity.
Yeah.
And also, immediately, as you say, everywhere it's being challenged, everywhere, you know, total monolithic absolutist allegiance to a single story, to a murderous and suicidal extent,
is being challenged.
That is being challenged.
Yeah,
and
everywhere.
That is what is hopeless. That is why I hope against that, because I still say that the big stories, people are not willing or able to drop them. But until they do, there is no hope. But at the same time, just the very dire nature of our situation is forcing us into opening up.
Yeah.
Because if we don't inquire, we won't survive.
Yeah.
So in that, I do hope against hope.
I do feel, in a sense, like the answer to the question, is there any hope for the human species, is sort of yes and no, in a way. I feel it does. It hangs in the balance, and it could go either way. But I'm optimistic because, as we said very early on in this, we have everything we need to bring about a peaceful world right now. And we are probably looking back at all the things which have gone on in the past, and particularly because I'm very interested in women and in society, because of watching all that those really good documentaries on the BBC. As a woman, I've never I am so privileged to be living now, where I am probably the most free of any time ever. Like, sometimes people talk about, oh, there was a golden age where we were more connected to the earth, where things were so much better. But I say no. I say the golden age is right now. This is the time when things have the most potential. It's like there is a great capacity and possibilities and opportunities all around us for the human species to really, really flourish. So I see the possibilities there, but as Pete mentioned, we need to have a world population who is encouraged to question and think. And if that occurs, which it seems that more and more, again, slowly but surely, it does seem to be, then I feel that there is hope, but we'll see.
We may not see, in fact.
We may not see. Oh, no, we won't.
Because we're thinking big scale, isn't it? We're thinking 100 years, 200 years. Well, it's not even that. It's not really big scale.
Yeah, we won't be around to see it.
We ain't going to be around to sort of.
But if we'd been having this conversation 50 years ago, and we were recording this saying, oh, is there any hope for the human race? I think if we could have had a premonition or a time machine to be transported right into this room now to see where we were now, what was happening in our society now, we'd be saying, oh, yes, there is hope. Look what's happened. You know, I'm not kind of pregnant barefoot in the kitchen and like, I don't know, dying in childbirth or dying of TB or whatever. Yeah. You know,
These are now small things.
Yeah.
These are now small things.
Even just in the last 50 years, the many wonderful things have actually happened. There's been great changes, hasn't there? As well as not very good ones as well, of course. So I'm on the side of hope, I think. Yeah. But as I said, it could go either way. But let's just hope that there is hope.